So before the break, I talked about upadana and its two meanings, one of taking up and the other one of fuel. And I explained how those two meanings, how they relate in slightly different ways to the idea of craving and rebirth, how it links those two together. And I sort of could have stopped my explanation of upadana there, and then we could have moved on with other factors, but I thought it would be nice to talk a little bit about a historical background of the word upadana and the similes of fuel and fire that we find a lot in the suttas. There's a lot of similes about fire and all these things, and why that may be. And I want to look a bit to the Brahmanical ideas on fuel and fire and food and all these related topics. And do you need to know this to understand dependent origination?
No.
You don't need to know this. Do you need to know this to become enlightened? No, not at all. You don't need to. But I thought it was interesting nonetheless, especially in a course like this where we have a lot of time to discuss dependent origination. I thought it would be nice to take a little bit of different angles, and especially since this is called dependent origination in early Buddhism, I think it's worthwhile to also ask ourselves what was the historical context of early Buddhism, because it gives us a little bit of an insight into the kind of environment that the Buddha was living in. We can only know so much, but the little bits that we do know, we can, gives us a bit more of a feel for how the Buddha lived and how the other people in the Buddha's time lived as well. So continuing on where we left off, so I'm now going to look at the Brahmin background to upadana. And I could not find any pictures of Brahmins, how at the time that their religion was founded, the Brahmins lived not in India yet. The Vedic texts that they, the Brahmins composed, they composed when they were still living in the to the northwest of India. And the northwest of India, you have these plains like you see here. And the Brahmins at that time, they were still nomadics, so they would travel on horses like this, and they would drive the cattle through the plains, and from there on they moved into India, and there they started settling, and they moved to other parts of the world as well. This is why in so many parts of the world we have all these related languages, is because these people, these nomads, they traveled all over the world and took their language with them. This is why now we have all these very similar languages. We call them the Indo-European languages. So in both in Europe and India and some parts of other parts of Asia, you find very similar languages because of these guys. Well, not these guys. These are like modern nomads, of course, because I couldn't find any pictures from so long back because they don't exist. Yeah. Yeah. But nobody really lives like that anymore. But I include these pictures because you can see this kind of landscape where there is no trees at all, yeah? And there is it would be very hard to find any wood to make anything or to light a fire, and also would be very hard to find food to sustain yourself. So it's no surprise then, I think, that when you read these very early Brahmin texts, that they continually worship things like food and fuel and fire. They worship them literally. Fuel or fire and food to them were almost like gods, which is understandable if you live in an environment like that, that you would start to worship these things, which are very rare. So, for example, when you search the oldest Brahmin text, the Vedic Rig Veda, and it's not such a very long text. You can read it in an afternoon or so, but if you search the Rig Veda for a word like fire, then you find more than 2,000 results If you search for the word food, you find 500 results. This is a lot, right? The word fire especially happens all the time. So these are the kind of people that moved into India and which Buddha had a lot of contact with. These people who talked about fire all the time. And you may remember last week I showed you a video, and this is a still from that video. You see these Brahmins, they're chanting, and they are around three fires, located around three fires. And this is a very ancient ritual that they did, and which is still performed in India to this day. And these three fires, they all have some sort of function that I don't know exactly. I'm not an expert on this at all, by the way, just so you know. But the Buddha refers to these kind of three fires as well in the suttas, and he, in many places in the suttas, we see the Buddha talking about the Brahmins worshipping their fire, and their god, the fire. The fire was a god to them. And I want to show you a little video of how such an how one of their rituals may have looked like. This is a video from Harvard University, and they went to some of the latest Brahmins in India and asked them to perform one of their most sacred rituals. And again, you see they have here the fire going, and this guy is chanting. I left out the sound because it's quite loud chanting, and it just goes on and on. Here he puts more fuel on the fire, right? And this ritual lasts for like more than a month, and they continually keep this fire going here. He's fanning the fire, you know. Basically, they're keeping their fire going all the time. And this is one thing the Brahmins had to do. The fire had to stay on basically for their entire life. Now they take a part of the fire, put it here in a pot, and this sort of represents the fire moving from earth and moving to heaven. He's now taking it to another altar, so it's this burning inside here, and he's still chanting. All they have to do all this chanting, and it has to all be correct according to their texts. That is what karma meant to them. To them, karma meant ritual. So this is also a reference to how the Buddha adopted the idea of karma to mean intention and not just correct ritual. I talked about the ritual the other time. So this guy is still chomping here and the fire in there. And now he moves it. This altar represents the heavenly plane. I know this because there is a commentator under the original audio or under the original video who explains all this. And so now you've got the fire burning here, and they're pouring more oil onto it, and they will also throw all sorts of kinds of food in it, like butter and ghee. And you find this even in the suttas, where the Buddha also says that the Brahmins are pouring butter and ghee into the fire. And there you see how this relationship between food and fuel. To the Brahmins, they were the same thing, because they feed their fire using food, basically. They throw oil and stuff into the fire. We say the same in English, we feed a fire. So in English, we also have this idea that of the close relationship between food and fuel. And one of the central concepts of these fire rituals is that by offering food into the fires like these, into these altars, by offering food and throwing them in and burning them, the idea was that the fire would eat that food and then bring it up to heaven to their forefathers who would live in heaven, and then this god fire would give the food to the forefathers, and so they could live forever in heaven, in the Brahman idea of heaven. The Brahmins, by the way, had many ideas, but this is one of the central ideas that they had. And this was just some text to give you some sort of an idea of what these guys were on about. I say guys because unfortunately the Brahmins, they only had men in their priestly function and no women. So just to give you an idea, you don't need to know what this means in detail because I also don't, but you get an idea anyway. I have beheld the might of this great being, Agni. Agni means fire, and in Pali it's Agni. His jaws now open and now shut together. So there's his jaws, his eating. Much they devour, insatiately chewing. So insatiately meaning always hungry, always chewing. His head is hidden. Well, fire, you can't see no head in it. Unsated, always hungry. With his tongue, he eats the fuel. The tongue is obviously the flames, right? So this is very much of an imagery. With hands upraised, for him, they quickly bring his food together. So that Brahmins, they bring the food for this this great being, Agni. So this was what they were doing in the Buddha's time all the time. And for example, sitting at a crossroad, always keeping a fire burning and offering food. And this is also one of the, what the Buddha says, this is wrong livelihood. And this is one of the verses also from the Rig Veda. We invoke you, Agni, the fire god, by whose mouth all these immortals, all these, like the forefathers, come to gain their food of life. And offerings come to the gods as food. This is what I just mentioned, that the offerings, they believe they would keep their forefathers alive. And also if they would do the right offerings with the right rituals, then when they would pass on, they would live forever in heaven. That was their idea. If they have just the right foods, the right fuel for their god, they would live forever. The immortals. Yeah. The word is amata, which is in Buddhism often called deathless. And this is another one from a little bit later text, but the concept is the same. All beings depend on food, both that breathe and those that do not. So those that don't breathe will be like, for example, the gods. Yeah, they don't need any oxygen. So all beings depend on food. And for the Brahmins, this was a good thing, right? Because they want to exist forever. So that's why they have to continually offer food to the fire, so they could keep both their forefathers and themselves living forever. So for the Brahmins, the idea was if they have food, or in other words, fuel, and they offer that, then they would end up having eternal life. Yeah. So for the Brahmins, that was good. For the Buddhists, of course, this is not so good. Eternal life, we've said that would imply eternal suffering, right? So I think the Buddha was reacting to this by adopting this word fuel, upadana, and using it in a different way. Because in the Buddhist tradition, it's not about keeping upadana going. The whole point is to get it to cease. And now remember this quote, all beings depend on food. This is very similar to a quote we find in the suttas in a number of places. And this is this one. All living beings are sustained by food, right? That is almost the same as all beings depend on food. Right? So it seems to me that the Buddha knew about that Brahmin text and adopted that line. But while for the Brahmins that was a good idea, to be sustained by food, to the Buddha, he says, when you're completely disillusioned by this one thing, lost desire for it, and are liberated from it, then you'll end all suffering. Which one thing? Well, all living beings are sustained by food. So the Buddha says, oh, don't just keep sustaining yourself with this fuel, this food all the time. That's not a good idea. You should be disillusioned by it. So to the Buddha, this is why I made this block green and the previous one was red. So green is good. No food, so no fuel, means no next life. Yeah, that's dependent cessation in action. So next time, for those of you who have kids, next time they look like this. Is that good? Now, of course, the Buddha didn't mean literal food. When he talks about food or the ahara, or when he talks about fuel, upadana, I said before, this is a metaphor. It's not literal food or literal fuel. It's like the food of craving, the fuel of craving that drives us on from life to life. That is what the Buddha said. We should stop. You should all eat your broccoli. Okay, so that was a little bit about the Brahmin background. There's like these kind of professors who know much more about this kind of stuff, but I think just knowing that little bit, that's basically all I know about it. But it gives you some sort of sense of why the Buddha may have included upadana there, maybe in the dependent origination, maybe it was to specifically address these sort of ideas. Could be. It's not 100% clear, but could be. So now the last topic I want to talk about, which is in a sense is the most important one, is when you have no fuel, you know, no craving, then there will be no rebirth. And see here this picture of the fire again that we saw before. So same sutta that I addressed then, but now in the negative. This is when a fire goes out, and then it will look like this. It will look like just a bunch of ashes, basically. So imagine if wood that's on fire, but nobody throws dry grass, cow dung, or wood onto it. So nobody throws any fuel onto it. When the fuel is used up and no new fuel is added, when that great bonfire runs out of food, ahara, it goes out. And this is, of course, a simile. Well, the word out here is nibbana. It goes out or it becomes extinguished. So here you see the Buddha using the word nibbana also as a simile. Yeah? We often think of nibbana as the goal of Buddhism. But nibbana is really just a simile for the goal. Because the real goal is to end craving and to end suffering. And nibbana means extinguishment of things like a fire. It's just a way to some analogy for the goal, not the real goal itself, you could say. Because that's not the goal, to put fires out. Likewise, when you focus on the problems with things, craving ceases. And when craving ceases, fuel will cease. When fuel ceases, life will cease. You know the problem of suffering. It's like knowing that things are on fire. Then you stop throwing new fuel onto it. You stop craving. Craving is like adding fuel. If you know the problem with things, then you will stop craving. It's really nice, really like a simple way of looking at the whole Dhamma, basically. We will stop craving if we just know enough about how things are problematic. Yeah? This is in a way is that saying, focus on the problems with things. If you understand the problems, that's when you no longer have avijja, no more delusion. Then craving ceases.
But it's things.
Yeah, things. It's was my abbreviation of whatever it was. No, not Dhamma. I made this text a bit shorter so I could read it faster, but things could be like, I don't know, can't remember the context, something, maybe the aggregates or something. Problem with things. Yeah, things. I don't know, can't remember. So yeah, this is the cessation mode of dependent origination. So no craving, means no fuel, no next life, and then of course it implies no more suffering. So that's good. So that's green. There's a little bit more behind this sutta though, I think, because there is a really the imagery of fire is used also in a couple of other suttas in combination with nibbana. And one of these suttas is the Vajragotha Sutta on fire, which is Majjhima Nikaya 72, quite a famous sutta. And I've also abbreviated it a little bit for the sake of presentation. So, Vajra, this is the same guy again that we saw in that other sutta. He has a lot of these questions all the time to the Buddha. Vajra seemed to be somebody who just didn't get it. He was asking the same kind of questions all the time. Maybe it's just like sort of a story, what do you call it? Maybe there were actually in actuality there were all different guys asking these questions, and for sake of transmission of the sutta they just always called him Vajra for some reason.
He became an arahant,
he did in the end. Yeah.
Ask a question about
the yeah He got it in the end. That's true. That's true. So maybe we should have ask more questions. And this is the question that the Vajra asked. So Vajra asked, what happens to an enlightened being after death? That this happens before in the sutta, but I abbreviated it here in the brackets. So what happens to an arahant after death? Actually, the question is, in a sense, already wrong. And we'll see why. The Buddha answered, Vajra, if a fire was burning in front of you, would you know that it was burning in front of you? Well, of course I would, Sir Gotama. What would you answer if somebody asked you what that fire depends on to burn? Depends is paticca. So in other words, what does the fire need to burn? Well, said Vajra, I'd answer it depends on fuel, upadana, to burn, like grass or wood, for example. So a fire is burning depending on fuel. You don't have a fire just burning out of nowhere. So when that fire went out, would you know that it went out? I would, answers Vajragotta. The Buddha, if somebody asked you in which direction that fire had gone, to the east, the west, the north, or the south, what would you answer? And then Vajragotta is like, what? That does not apply. The fire depends on the fuel to burn. If the fuel runs out and no new fuel is added, the fire can only be called out. Out is nibbana. It can only be called extinguished, right? So, if I would take a match. Came prepared. The fire is burning on the match. Ooh, suffering. And then? Oh, the this is what happens when you practice Buddhism and you just don't get it. Yeah. So, now where did the flame go? Where's the flame? Yeah, out! It didn't go anywhere. Yeah. It didn't go to the eternal flame heaven, as Ajahn Brahm says when he talks about the sutta. There's no eternal heaven where all flames live happily forever after. The flame just ceases. It disappears. It stops to be. You just saw it right here in front of your eyes. Makes total sense what that means, right? First there is a flame, and then when there's no more fuel, the flame stops. The fire stops or ceases. Or it goes out, nibbana. And this is a simile for what happens to an enlightened being after death. This sutta goes on a bit further, but it basically means an enlightened being is just a process, just like a flame. A flame is not a thing. A flame has no essence to it. Flame is inherently empty of any core or essence that would be able to live forever. And the same applies to all of us. All living beings, we have no essence inside of us that is eternal, that could last forever. And therefore, if you see this and you're enlightened, you don't go anywhere. Yeah, just like the flame, you don't go anywhere. You just cease to be. So therefore, the question, what happens to an enlightened being after death, is already wrong, because it implies that there is somebody, there is a being there, that goes somewhere. It sort of implies that there is a self in there. So that's the idea that Vajragotta has. He thought, well, I exist right now. If I am enlightened, where do I go? I can't just cease to be. But this is exactly what the point of the Buddha's teachings is, that we are all empty processes which can eventually cease. And to me that makes total sense, because you look at other things in nature, not just flames, but all other things, like from little blades of grass to stars, they all not essences. A blade of grass can fall apart, and even stars, they can die, they don't last forever. So why would you human beings have something inside of them that lasts forever? Or any beings for that matter. that's just looking at it from an outside perspective. But of course, we've mentioned it before. If you really want to see this, it comes down to your meditation, and we'll discuss that a bit more hopefully next week. So that's about fire running out of fuel. Yeah. Does that make sense to people? Does that imagery? Do you think you get that? Yeah. It's often misunderstood though, because there's often people who think that after enlightenment there's still some part of the Arahant, still consciousness after they die, still continues somehow. But I think that is misinterpreting things like this sutta, which to me is very clear. So, a fire running out of fuel, right? But what that is, an image which to the people at the time of the Buddha would be very even more lively than now, because they depended on fire for everything, right? They didn't have any electrical lights, so all their lamps were oil lamps and candles and stuff like that, had fire for that. Cooking they had fires for. We saw these Brahmins with the fires. They made bricks using fires, everything with fire. So this imagery was very alive to them. And they would have no misunderstanding what Nirvana meant. Nirvana just means going out of a flame, or the extinguishment of a flame. Maybe a little bit less alive for us now, this fire imagery. So what does it mean to you when I say, oh, I ran out of fuel? Well, you see this, right? On your car? That's what it means for us to run out of fuel. So maybe when your fuel gauge is empty, yeah. So maybe we can use that imagery. No more fuel. You're not going anywhere. All right. So if that fire imagery doesn't do it for you, maybe you can think in terms of this. Want to finish off this little bit about Upadana with one sutta that we chant very often, one part of this sutta, which is the Ratana Sutta. And we chant it often at house blessings, and in the monastery we chant it often. It goes ki nang puranang navang nati sambhavang virata chitta yatike bhavasming te ki nabija avirul hichanda nimhanti dhira yathayang padipo idham pisanghe ratanang panitang ete nasacce nasuvati hotu. And some of you might know that, especially in Sri Lanka, they also chant this a lot. And what does it mean? Ending the old, Kinang Purana, meaning ending this body that they have in this life. Nothing new coming to be. No new existence. Their minds have no desire for a future life. Life is bhava. We've seen independent origination. Te kinabija, they ended the seed. The seed, well, what is this? Ended the seed. This refers to that imagery that I was talking to you before last week, planting the seed of consciousness. With no desire to sprout, like that is implies no desire for having another life. Those wise ones who have no desire for future life, yeah, no desire. They will go out. Nibbana, Nibbanti, Nibbanti Dhirang, the wise ones will go out. Like this flame, Yatayang Padipa, literally like this lamp, but a lamp in their time, of course, always implied the flame. You know, they didn't have lamps like we do now. We'll go out like this flame. So maybe the Buddha was holding up an oil lamp while he was chanting this sutta and did basically the same thing that I did with that match before, who knows? Because it used the word this there, but now you go out like this flame, yeah, implying they will cease burning, and they will cease, like the flame will cease, right? And cessation sounds very frightening to many of us, That was before there was this question about vibhava tanha, the desire to be annihilated. Yeah? And cessation can often sound like annihilation to us when you have a sense of self. But think of yourself in terms of a flame, burning flame. That's actually quite nice to have that to go out, to have a flame go out, because flames are burning and they hurt a lot. Yeah? There's this sutta, the Adita Sutta. Everything is burning. Another sutta which uses the imagery of fire. And there's many more like this. So this excellent treasure exists in the Sangha. So there do exist people who have no more desire for future life. And if we recollect that, by that truth, may there be well-being for all of us. And that's where I like to stop. This is about Upadana. Maybe we can have a little breather and do some little questions, and then Ajahn Brahmani will tell you a bit more about Upadana from another perspective, I think, and also some of the other factors as well. Ding. Couldn't reach the bell. Okay. So, if there's any questions, please find the microphone. And by the way, if anybody is interested for this video, maybe only a few of you were interested in this kind of thing, but if you are, then Google Altar of Fire and you'll find it. It's like half an hour long, made by Harvard and some other universities, so they have more explanations about what's going on.
Ajahn, hello.
Yes, working for.
Hello.
No doubt in my mind. I mean, we as human beings, humans, go through all these steps, and dependent origination is quite valid for us. Okay.
Can you speak a bit closer to the microphone, maybe?
Hello. Hello. There's no doubt that these steps apply to humans. But how do they apply to lower realms of animals, insects, that sort of thing? I think their craving is to survive and food and eat. Other than that, would they have all these other conditions that create next birth or eventually? Do you think that applies to all?
Yeah,
it should apply to all beings, but just trying to clear my mind.
Oh yeah,
how it would apply to, you know, beings without any developed sense faculties, please.
Yeah. Thank you. First of all, I would say I don't think about those kind of things a lot, because to me, I'm a human being, so I just focus on the perspective of being a human being, and not really that concerned about what happens to a mosquito or something, because I'm not. But having said that, though, it is an interesting thing to think about. How does it apply to insects and other animals, right? And other beings. Dependent origination does apply to all beings, because they're all included in samsara, except for enlightened beings, of course. Those are excluded from dependent origination, but the rest is all included. And it may be that some of the details of dependent origination don't apply so much to certain animals. For example, they may not have all the senses or whatever, those kind of details. But in the end, it's still a craving to exist. As you said, they just want to survive, right? And they want to... no living being gets born with the intention to die right away. You know, all beings get born and they want to stay alive, at least initially. Sometimes people get depressed and they want to die, but that's a different subject. Generally, everybody wants to live, and all beings want to live as well. This, you could say, is like the desire, the craving, or the fuel, if you want, for them to keep existing if they die as well. And our human life is quite long, yeah? So we develop a lot during one life, so we can go from totally ignorant to totally enlightened, possibly. But other beings may have much shorter or even much longer lives, and maybe when lives are much shorter, then maybe the influence of past lives becomes bigger as well. So maybe for animals, their influence, their intentions of their past life may have more of an influence on how they continue in samsara as well. So maybe it's not just so much about what they're doing in this life, because, for example, a fruit fly, can they make good or bad karma? It's very hard to say, right? I don't think so. When you just look at a fruit fly, there's not much good or bad they can do, but maybe they did good and bad in lives before, when they maybe were a human being. And maybe that karma comes up again when the fruit fly dies, and maybe that influences their rebirth. sort of guessing because, as I said, I'm not a mosquito or a fruit fly, so. Please, Eddie. Yeah.
You talk about Nibbana, that is not giving fuel, okay? So what came to my mind is, my understanding of Nibbana is, what I was saying, is the ending of greed, hatred, and delusion, you know?
Yes.
So we can also fit, how to fit in, there's also greed too. Don't put fire maybe to greed. Anger too. And yeah. Delusion is wrong thought.
So, this goes a little bit more in detail than I plan to, but there's two kinds of Nibbana. Well, the word Nibbana literally means going out of a fire. That's what literal meaning is. But that meaning is applied as a symbol for an arahant passing away and then going out. But we said also, Nibbana is also used for greed, hatred, and illusion going out, for the moment of enlightenment itself. Yeah. So that is... where that same simile is used for something that is slightly different, and not the moment that arahant passes away. That is called Nibbana, sometimes called Parinibbana, but the moment they become enlightened is also called Nibbana. Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's one sutta that in the Itivutaka 43 or something that is about the two kinds of Nibbana, and I've given a talk about that before here. So if you want a more detail, then you can watch that, and I think we'll answer your question. Yeah. All right, some quickies from online. The going out of the bonfire is not Nibbana, but the end of existence, the bhava of the being. The bonfire refers to the being. Is that correct? I think so. You could refer to it like that because the word for bonfire used is also kanda, so it seems to refer to that. Yeah. That's one of the suttas we were talking about. But again, yeah, there's two ways to use the word nibbana. One is the end of existence, and the other one is the end of the defilements. Those are separate. What's the difference between extinguishment, so Nibbana, and nihilism? Nihilism. What's nihilism?
I think annihilationism is probably what they're referring to.
Oh, annihilation, yeah. So we sort of addressed that already. When I think of nihilism, it's like this painting, like Rubens or something. Annihilation is would be theoretically something that exists, stops to exist. But Nibbana is just a process coming to an end. Yeah. That's where the question from. I know that's a very brief answer, but we have to have some time also for some very wise words from Ajahn Bamali.
Yeah, okay, we'll find out. Okay. So,
Fire away,
great.
Fire away,
that's bad news, isn't it? Fire away. Can we put it up properly on the screen, please? Can't receive what's going on here. Yeah. Okay, let's carry on. So, thank you, Venerable Sunil, for the explanation of the connection between Upadana and fire. Is actually quite interesting, and the idea of fuel, and he has looked into this much more than I have, that's why he made a long exposition on this. It's actually quite interesting, and it adds a dimension to the idea of Upadana that maybe is not always talked about, and it connects it with the early teachings of the Vedas and the Brahmins and all of that, so it's actually quite fascinating, I think. But what I want to do now, I want to look at a more traditional way of thinking of Upadana, the idea of taking up, which I think is probably a very literal translation of the word. But one of the things that we find in the suttas is that the words like Upadana, they are used very often together with a number of other words, like Abhinivesa or Aditana even. And these words have more the idea of not just taking up, but also holding on to afterwards, like grasping things, maybe even attaching to them and all of that. So these are ideas that kind of come in here, and they obviously apply to the sequence of dependent origination. Whether upadana literally means that or not, they certainly are part of this process of existence and of creating karma and all of these things that then lead on to rebirth in the future. So what I'm going to look at now is how craving then leads to this idea of taking up, and then how taking up and grasping then, how that shapes your life. Yeah, this is what the next factor then is, bhava, which when Musunda here is translated as life, which is more often translated as existence. But life is quite nice, yeah, it's kind of short and sweet, and it means largely the same thing. And then how that existence that you have, how you exist, then leads on to rebirth in the future. So we're going to look, coming very close now to the end of dependent origination, getting close to the kind of the what this is all about, really. So again, taking up and grasping, there, what I'm going to have a look at now is the four kinds of grasping. There are, in the suttas, the way that upadana is defined as four kinds of upadana. The first one is the kam upadana that you see here. So this is the taking up and the grasping and even attachment to the sensual objects of the world. And when we, one of the very important points that I mentioned before, and which I think I probably should mention again, when we talk about the word karma, yeah, the word karma is one word, kamma is a different word. Kamma means action. Karma means the sensual, sensory objects of the world. Now, the karma has two aspects to it. And one is the desire aspect. Yeah, we desire these worldly things in the world. But the other aspect is actually the objects themselves. So when you see a word like karma upadana, it actually means, one of the main meanings is attachment or taking up or holding on to all of this sensory existence, all the sensory objects of the world. Yeah, this is what it's about. So when we think about our life, yeah, what it is like to be a human being, one of the things that you realize very quickly is that almost our entire life is spent immersed in the sensory world. Yeah, everything is really about the play of the five senses. From the moment you wake up in the morning, and then all day is about seeing things, feeling things, tasting things, all of this, yeah? And then you go to night, you go to bed at night, and then you kind of say goodbye to that world for a few moments, and you start dreaming. And what do you dream about? More of the sensory world. Yeah, it's just, we can't get away from the sensory world. So no wonder we have attachment to this. Everything we do is an immersion into that sensory realm. So what happens is that because we live in that realm and we crave and we feel in that realm, yeah, we have feelings related to that sensory world. We like things, we dislike things. From that then comes the craving, yeah, obviously. So we crave mostly within the realm of the sensory world. We crave for sensory objects, for sensory experiences, and we also have aversion to certain sensory experiences. Yeah? The craving arises, and as soon as you have craving, you want to do something about that craving. You want to satisfy it. That is the very nature of craving, is that we want to satisfy it. And that movement towards satisfying craving, that initial movement is the taking up of something. Yeah, I'm thirsty. Take up. Yeah, you take up. Yeah, so this is kind of the initial point of craving. And that is what we do in the sensory realm all the time. Yeah, you have a cup of tea, or you pick something up that you want to eat, or you start watching something, nice entertainment, or you whatever it is. We pick things up. We start things. And this is how we then engage with that sensory world, trying to satisfy these desires that are always there. So, but this is very, very broad. Yeah? One thing is the fact that we pick up things like this, just kind of pick them straight up to satisfy immediate desires. But it is also much more long term. It doesn't not just mean picking up in the literal sense. It also means picking up in a more, in a broader sense, metaphorical sense. And many of the things that we pick up in life are large things, yeah, broad things. We pick up certain habits. We pick up living in a house. Why do you want to live in a house? Well, lots of good reasons for living in a house, yeah, much better than living under a bridge. Is that right? Yeah, for some people, for most people, it's better to have a house than to live under a bridge. Yeah, but why? Because you are comfortable, you are away from the rain, you can control the temperature, you can have your entertainment there, you have your living room, you can invite your mates back home, you can have a nice dinner together. There's endless good reasons why we have a house and why we have a home. You feel kind of safe, you lock the door at night, keep the burglars out, yeah? So all of these things are really what... you know, what this is about, yeah, the sensory realm. So we take up living in a house. It's about part of the sensory realm. Then we have a job. Why do we have a job? Well, one reason is to make an income. Yeah. Why do you want to have an income? So again, to be able to satisfy the things that you need in life and also the things that you desire is very closely related to satisfying the desire in the sensory realm. You also have a job because of status, perhaps, yeah? It is not the same status to live under that bridge, yeah? Where are you living? Oh, I live under that bridge. Oh, really? Okay, see you later, yeah. You're not, you know, we. It is a certain status about having a job, yeah? You're a Buddhist monk? Okay, that's okay with some people. With other people, oh, yeah. Okay, don't have anything to do with you if you're a Buddhist monk. But with Buddhists, it's great to be a Buddhist monk, yeah? It's kind of nice, yeah. So it satisfies all of these things in the sensory realm. And then we take up certain hobbies, we take up certain, certain kinds of entertainment that we enjoy. Yeah? And after a while, you start to realize that your whole life starts to revolve around these things. Yeah, your whole life becomes these things. I sometimes speak to my brother who lives back in Norway, and ask him what his life is like. Oh, my life is just running around all day, doing things. Yeah? There's no time to sleep, no time to do anything except for running. He's got two children, he's got a wife, a big house, and two children. And just full activity all the time, yeah, continuously. So your entire life revolves around these things. It becomes your existence, yeah, these things. And you can see how the craving makes us take these things up to secure those cravings, the upadana, grasping onto things, attaching them, and then our existence takes a certain shape based on that upadana. Yeah? You live in that sensory realm and you start to form your life around that. Of course, after a while, you may start to realize that there's more to life than the sensory existence. Yeah? Sensory existence actually is often quite precarious. Sometimes we don't know what's going to happen around the corner. Sometimes it looks like the world is going in the wrong direction. Sometimes, you know, things just go wrong in that realm. So we become a bit more wary of that realm. Right view is starting to make itself manifest inside of us. We're starting to think more like the Buddha is thinking. Our outlook aligns more with the Dhamma. And so you withdraw a little bit of interest from the sensory realm and you start instead to take more interest in spiritual matters. Yeah? And you start to think more in terms of, actually, maybe I should try to be more peaceful. Yeah? Maybe I should try to find more joy, maybe in a different realm, through being kind, through being virtuous and all of these kind of things. And then you take up new practices. You start coming to the Buddha Society. Yeah, you come to the dependent origination class. Yeah, these kind of things. And you start doing spiritually. You come and stay at the monastery for a while. If you are a bit nuts, you become a monk or a nun. Yeah? And you do all of these kind of things. And your life takes a new direction. And because your life takes a new direction, it is like you exist in a new way. You exist in a slightly different realm. Your mind inclines towards new things. Yeah, and your existence starts to take a new course. Yeah, this is very similar. You will remember I spoke about this also at the very beginning when we talked about sankharas and vijnana and how the sankharas based on avidya, on ignorance, then establishes consciousness depending on what those sankharas, yeah, these are the willed activities of the mind, how that does something to your mind, how it makes you either feel light or heavy, or how it, you know, how it affects your mind. This is parallel to that, a slightly different angle of attack on how we're looking at this. So you can see here how these upadanas, these attachments, then create our existence, how they are based on craving, and they lead on to a particular kind of life. Yeah. The second one of these upadanas is the dit upadana, and dit upadana, grasping of views. Yeah. And in Buddhism, this can mean a variety of things, but very often it refers to, in particular, views like the eternalist view or the annihilationist view. So why do we take up these views? Well, the reason is because there is a craving for identity inside of us. Yeah. So you feel certain feelings, yeah, and you know that when you hear the word eternalism, God is looking after you. Oh, that feels so nice. Okay, I believe in God. Yeah? That's how it works. That's actually very often very simple. We are so simple, really, when it comes down to it. We make things very complicated by adding all this intellectual superstructure. But the root of things is very simple. Yeah? Okay, you are eternal. When you die, you will go to God. God is really, really nice. Yeah? I really recommend hanging out with God. Okay, that's me. That's me. Yeah, okay. From now on, I believe in God, and I believe in the eternal life. Why? Because it feels good. Yeah, so it comes from this idea, this sense of identity. I feel like I am somebody. I want to be happy. And if somebody gives you a theory that matches with that, well, then you will accept that. Yeah, very often, unless you have reasons to doubt it, you will accept those things, and you will go along with that. And once you are committed to that, once you are attached to that, once you have taken up that view, this is again taking up, nothing in the world can detach you from that view. Why? Because it becomes an aspect of your identity, of who you are. Yeah, it becomes very, very dear to you. And the same thing is true also for the annihilationist view. Yeah, you think, oh yeah, God existing forever with God. Actually, I don't like that idea at all. Yeah, I don't really know anything about this God. Is this God really nice? Maybe this God is not so nice. Maybe this God will do bad things to me. Well, you know, if God created this world, it's not, you know, did a pretty poor job. There's lots of volcanoes and a kind of natural disasters and climate change. And surely this God would have done a better job. Yeah, I'm not so sure if this God is nice or not. So, okay, don't want to get reborn and live forever with God. So, but actually, there's an alternative theory. Yeah, when you die, everything just comes to an end. Yeah, that makes more sense to me. Yeah, and so you grasp onto that idea, and you think that it fits with modern outlooks of science. It feels good to you, and because it feels good for you, you crave that view, and then you take it up as a consequence, and then you believe in that. But all of these things, ultimately, they are based on feelings. Yeah, they are based on what feels right to us. And then we add a little bit of logic on top of that. Yeah, we add kind of our ideas of the world. And then we think that Buddhism is just an ancient superstition, so you can't really believe in rebirth. Okay, so these are the options that are left. Yeah, and so these are the views. And, you know, but it's not obviously not just about religious views. It is also about political views. Yeah, it's a very interesting thing. I don't know what kind. I'm not going to ask you about your political views because we get into a bun fight very quickly if you start asking about political views. So please keep them to yourself. It doesn't really matter. Everyone is welcome to the Buddhist Society, regardless of your political views. Except maybe if you have some really extreme political views, maybe then you know you may not fit in here so well. Like you know. All beings should die now. Yeah, that kind of political view is no good in the Buddhist society. But apart from that, we can accept a very broad range of views as long as you live according to Buddhist ideas. But it's fascinating, yeah, how we often take so much pride in our political views and how we're willing to defend them. Yeah, this is my political view. I am right. I know because this is logical. Yeah, you have to look after the economy, and if you don't look after the economy properly, everything is going to go down the drain. Yeah, and we know that. It can be proven. It can be shown. And someone else is going to come with the exact opposite point of view, would equally, irreproachable logic, yeah, and have the exact opposite. And very often, the point of my political views is that they too are often rooted in feelings. Yeah, we have grown up in a certain way with certain parents, in a certain culture, in a certain society, and then our political views then take shape according to how we grow up. And then later on, we often then use logic to defend something which actually has more to do with feeling than it has to do with logic. And this is one of the things I find so fascinating, and I did mention this before, that our views are so connected to what we, how we, what it feels like. Yeah, logic is just some kind of, often logic works in defense of what feels right. Yeah, logic is kind of trapped by what already feels like, and then we use the logic to support the views that we already believe in. And then, you know, when you're young, you have one political view, and then when you get older, you change your political views, and both times you feel equally right about them. Yeah, and it's kind of very, all is very precarious and very dodgy. And at the end of the day, they are just competing ideas, and who knows if any of them are really true, or if the truth actually is much more profound and difficult to sustain. And that's what we say, in a sense, in Buddhism. Yeah, in one way, all political views are just temporary. And ultimately, if you want to create true happiness in the world or something, you actually have to look in a very different direction. So we take up these views. And when we take up these views, then our life takes a certain direction again. Yeah, you believe in God, and then you act as if you believe in God. You make karma in that way. Or if you take up certain political views, again, you make karma according to that. And then you exist according to those views. That too becomes part and parcel of this existence package of who you are. So that's grasping of views. Then we have the sila bhat upadana, which is the grasping of precepts and observances. Yeah, you will notice that sila here is the usual word that we use in Buddhism. That means morality or precepts or habits and these kind of things. And bhatta is a word, Pali word, which really comes from bhatta. Bhatta means like habits, also habits that we have, yeah, observances that we do. Rituals is also included in that. Yeah, in the suttas, there are like religious habits that people will take on. Like, you know, practice in the Catholic example in the suttas is the person who pretends to be like an ox. Yeah. Walks around like an ox all the time, yeah, saying moo, moo, and then ox, the ox duty ascetic. Yeah, oh, I have to be careful, I become an ox duty ascetic. Yeah. Or the dog duty ascetic, yeah, same thing. You lie down on the ground, you curl up at night, yeah, and then you eat from the dirt and these kind of things. You become the dog duty ascetic. Yeah. But it goes much further than that. Yeah, everybody, we all have like little habits, little rituals that we do, yeah, in life. This is very part and parcel of life. And also in, as a Buddhist, we have these things. Even if you are an atheist, you have rituals that you do. Yeah, you have ways that you live that kind of makes life easy and go smoothly, like shaking hands or saying good morning to people, or brushing your teeth in the morning, or having certain food for breakfast. You know, life is often ritualized to a large extent to make things become easier for us. And we then attach to those rituals. Yeah, we take them up. Yeah, and then when we take them up, we act out those habits over the long term. And in Buddhism, we do the same thing. Yeah, we come to the temple, we bow down to the Buddha. Yeah, that is like a ritual. Or you light the incense and the candles. That's also a kind of ritual. So is that bad or is it good? And that is kind of the critical thing here, yeah? If we take them on as rituals, as things that we attach to, and it becomes mere attachments, and we don't take it further than that, then it can become an obstacle on the path, because we just do all of these things in a blind kind of way. But if we use these things instead, not just because we are attached to them, but we use them in a way whereby they actually have an effect on us, yeah, where they develop us in a certain way, then there can become a positive contribution in our practice. So when you bow down to the Buddha, then try to do it in a way which actually develops your mental qualities. What are you really bowing down to? Who is this person called the Buddha anyway? Yeah? Are you bowing down to the Buddha? Or are you bowing down to the qualities of the Buddha? Well, there isn't really any difference. It's the same thing, the Buddha and his qualities. You can't really separate them. And then when you think about what you're bowing down to, and you feel that these things are really worthy of respect, they are really worthy of bowing down, then it does something to you. It does something to your heart, yeah? You start to feel more confidence and faith. You start to feel perhaps even a sense of joy. Wow, I'm so fortunate to have this Buddha as my teacher here. It's amazing that such a person can even exist. A person who has penetrated and fully understand what human happiness and suffering is about. Isn't that incredible that such a being should even exist in this world? And here we still have access to the teaching of this person. And then you really feel like bowing down. This is like the ultimate teacher who can teach you the highest thing that is possible to teach from any teacher. This is what we're all seeking at the end of the day, happiness and moving away from suffering. And here is someone who has the ability to take this to the highest level, yeah, all the way to the complete fulfillment of what it means, the meaning of life, if you like. Well, it is just, the more you think about that, the more amazing it is. And if you bow down to the Buddha with those kinds of thoughts in your mind, it becomes extraordinarily powerful. And this is a way of doing Buddha Anusati, Buddha contemplation. Yeah? And then you can afterwards, when you meditate, you can bring that memory back into your mind. Wow, this is my teacher. Wow, and then you can be fit. That can actually, sometimes, I'm not saying it is easy, it takes practice, but if you do it in the right way, sometimes it can give rise to this marvelous joy and happiness that we have this extraordinary teacher in the world who has understood the human condition so profoundly. It's like, whoa, it's hard to believe. Yeah, the greatest spiritual genius in human history. What a wonderful thing that is. And then you are using this upadana, yeah, this picking up of certain rituals, you're using it in a way that actually becomes very useful. Yeah, so this is, again, the difference between using the upadana merely as a ritual and then adding something to it that actually makes it more profound, makes it deeper, makes it more meaningful. And there are so many cases of this in Buddhism where we can do things more meaningfully. Yeah, when we do the chanting, it's the same thing. You can do the chanting in an empty way, blah, 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 or what am I thinking about? Or what am I going to shop tomorrow? Blah, 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 blah. Oh, I think I've shopped this, cooked this. Yeah. And this is very common. It happens with me sometimes. I sit in the monastery, we do the chanting on Wednesday night, and suddenly I think about, oh, tomorrow I've got this work project going on. Yeah? Wait a minute, I'm chanting a Metta Sutra, for goodness sake. Maybe I should focus on that instead. Yeah? But because you know the chant so well, it just comes out automatically, yeah, and your mind is somewhere else. Yeah? And you're wasting the opportunity. Yeah, you're wasting a chance to reflect on the word of the Buddha. These are powerful words with beautiful meaning. Yeah? If you reflect on it in the right way, if you understand that this is beautiful Dhamma that you're hearing, you actually get inspired. It lifts you up. You are doing Dhamma Nusati, recollection of the Dhamma. You're not just making these things into a ritual. The same thing can happen with meditation practice. Sometimes you hear people doing meditation. Yeah, yeah, I meditate once a day, half an hour in the morning. Yeah. You've got to meditate, right? You're a Buddhist. You have to meditate. So I just, you know, I do it just to kind of get it out of the way. So then I can carry on with my rest of my stuff. And sometimes meditation becomes like that. It becomes something we do ritualistically, yeah, because it is what you're supposed to be doing. Please don't fall into that trap, because it just becomes another upadana, something you take up, something you attach to, and something which stops having an effect on your spiritual life. If that is what's happening, then stop for a while instead. Don't meditate. Yeah, do something else, then come back to it. If you fall into really bad habits with your meditation, it is more destructive than constructive. Pull back a little bit. Okay, what am I doing wrong? how can I add more mindfulness to my meditation practice? How can I add more joy to it? More inspiration, all of these very important things. And as you do that, then when you come back to it again, it lifts you up and it has a new quality to it. And meditation should always be developing. It should always be moving forward. Yeah, from year, from month to month, maybe not month to month, but from, you know, every 6 months or so, you should see there is an improvement. Your mindfulness is getting better. Your defilements are going down. And if this is not happening, you should ask yourself why. Why isn't this happening? And then when you ask yourself why, that is when you're asking the critical question. Because this is the question which will help you to unearth that treasure. That treasure which sees your defilements clearly, which sees the obstacles clearly. And when you see them clearly, then you have the possibility of eliminating those obstacles in the future. So please have these upadanas. Please take up meditation. Please take up rituals like chanting, like bowing down, like lighting incense, like coming to Dhamma talks. That too can become a ritual. But please make them meaningful. Make them something that enhances the path. They don't just become empty things in our life. And if they become empty things, then they become silabhata paramasa. Silabhata paramasa means literally holding on to virtue. Yeah, holding on to precepts. Yeah, I'm going to keep the five precepts. And after you have kept the five precepts for 10 years, it's automatic. Yeah, you don't have to think about it anymore. So what you need to do then is do more. How can I become even better? Yeah, because that too can just become a habit. How can I become more kind? How can I add something to my sila? Not just keep these things like a parrot. Yeah. How can I actually become an even better person? How can I speak more words of kindness? How can I have more thoughts of kindness in my life? How can I overcome the silly anger that I still harbor sometimes in my heart? And then in this way, again, even the sila part does not become a mere ritual. But it becomes something that you develop over time and you create more and more out of it, make more and more out of it, developing, bringing it up, making it more, and then it will affect your meditation, your mindfulness, and all of these things in a gradual but sustained kind of way. This is how you move forward on the path. And that is why the path is so demanding. Because you always have to inquire. You always have to ask yourself, how, what do I need to do to take it a step further? And sila is really the core thing that makes this whole path work. So you can make it a paramasa, an attachment, or you can make it something which is, I like this, I talked a lot about this during the rains retreat at Bodhidharma Monastery as well, and Venerable Karunika was there, and she made the important distinction between silabhata can either be a paramasa, which is like an attachment, or it can be a dhamma patipati, which means a practice in accordance with the dhamma. Yeah? And this is how you make the difference. You do it as something automatic, or you put the effort into developing these things in a good way. Yeah? And you can see how now all of these things together, how they really shape your life. Yeah, all the big picture things, how you lead your life in living in the sensory world, your views about things, yeah, and even all the kind of little observances that we do and the virtues that we live by and all of these things. If you put all of those things together, it's pretty much your whole life. There isn't much outside of that, yeah. Is there anything outside of that? Maybe deep sleep is outside of that? I don't know. There's not much outside of that. Pretty much everything is included in this. Your life takes a certain shape. And as your life takes a certain shape, you exist in that way. And that is then the bhava, yeah, the existence or the life that comes from that. There's one more upadana. It's called the attavad upadana. This is the grasping of theories of a self. Yeah, I'm going to carry on a little bit longer before opening up for questions. There's no way I'm going to be able to finish what I had planned to, but some of it doesn't matter so much. That's fine. So grasping theories of a self, this is very similar again to what I said before about views. I should probably have saved it for now. The idea of, you know, eternalist views and annihilationist views, and also things like you know, how we relate the self to the five khandhas, you know, what do you take to be yourself, your consciousness, or maybe your will you take to be yourself, or certain perceptions about yourself, or your body, and how you relate to that, whether yourself you take it to be inside this, or this belongs to you, and all of these various ways. There's 20 ways that the idea of Sakkāya-ditti means personality view, yeah, related to this, is described in the Majjhima Nikaya number 2, the Sabbasava Sutta, the Sutta on all the defilements. So if you want to look it up, you can have a look at the Majjhima Nikaya number 2, Sabbasava Sutta on all the defilements. I apologize, I'm probably going really fast now, but yeah. Anyway, so you can, that's all there. So these are the four upadanas, yeah, and then this is all in response to craving, yeah. You crave securities. You crave to have regularities in your life. So you take up the observances and you take up all of these things, and then your life takes a shape. Your existence takes a shape from that. So that's how you move from taking up and grasping from upadana to existence. Yeah, and this existence, as I mentioned before, has very much to do with what you are interested in, yeah, because the things that we attach to and hold on to, that is what we are interested in, yeah. So you exist in that. That is what your interest is, and that is where your mind inclines. That is what you tend to think about. That is what where your mind moves as soon as you it has a chance. And as I mentioned last time, the way to find out where your mind inclines, it is not enough just to look at what happens superficially during the day, because the day is so fragmented, often too many things happening to really be able to have a deep look at yourself. But if you go on a meditation retreat and you relax and you allow the superficial turmoil of the mind to calm down, then that remaining inclination of the mind, the remaining bias of the mind that you have when things calm down, what happens then? What are you interested in then? Do you tend to think about all the things in the world? Or do you tend to think about peace? Yeah, think about all of these positive things that we talk about on the Buddhist path. And I'm sure many of you will know exactly what I'm talking about, yeah? When you go on a meditation retreat, yeah? When you, after day 3 or 4, where is your mind at after day 3 or 4? What are you thinking about? And you will know that sometimes maybe you do feel peaceful, but other times your mind will be preoccupied with the worldly things. Yeah. And for some of you who are very busy people who have a lot to do, often the mind will not be able to let go of those worldly things. Why? Because you have taken them up, because you are attaching to them, because they mean something to you. You have invested things in them. You are craving too much there. And what you need to do is to change your outlook, change your understanding, to undermine that craving, and then things start to turn around. So again, look at that interest of your mind. Yeah, you experience that inclination when you go on meditation retreats. Yeah, and then you can feel what your inclination, what your existence really is like, and you start to understand yourself better. And the advantage of that, I should point out, is if you understand yourself, you start to understand what it is that you have to do. Why is it that my mind is so going to all of these worldly things? Why do I find so much delight there? Actually, deep down, I realize that these problems are endless. Do I really want to go onto this endless stream of problems stretching out into infinity? If you know that the problem that you're solving now, you're going to have to solve it an infinite number of times in the future, it becomes much less interesting, yeah? Because you forget that you have solved it before, and then you have to do it again. And after a while, it becomes madness to solve these things. If you know that this misunderstanding you had with other people, the argument that you had with somebody, you're going to have to carry on with these arguments and misunderstandings for infinite time. After a while, this whole realm starts to seem very unpleasant, and you start to turn inwards, and you start to turn towards peace and the meaningful things on the spiritual path instead. So you learn to think differently, to think about the world in a different way, to find satisfaction and contentment in a different realm. And that is then the station of your consciousness, yeah? You are stationed where your inclination is. And hopefully we can all alter that station in this life. This is an important part of what practicing the Dhamma is about, changing your station of consciousness, changing where your mind inclines, yeah? Moving the inclination towards more spiritual things, away from the more worldly things. And then you can see, and this is one of those marvelous things that you will observe, yeah? I can see that after having been a monk for 25 years, yeah? When I started out, I was just this hopeless kind of, you know, person, just, you know, thinking about all kind of worldly things. But then gradually, things are moving in the right direction. I'm not making any claims, by the way. I'm just saying, you know, I have a long way to go, but at least it's going in the right direction. That's all I'm saying here. Which is great, yeah? When you feel it's going in the right direction, you feel, yay, this works. And this is what you can see. Your station of consciousness is changing. You're less interested in worldly things. You're more and more inclining to the Dhamma, to the spiritual things instead. Yeah? And that is very marvelous when you see that. And then when you die, then that inclination you have when you die, that station of consciousness that you have when you come to the end of your life, where your mind is leaning, that is where you get reborn. Yeah, closely related to each other. Just like we were talking before about consciousness, yeah, and sankhara and the willed activities, and then how consciousness is stationed in the same way. Okay. Okay, I'm not going to go much more. Let's just have a quick look at one little sutta. Yeah, so this is from the Connected Discourse of the Buddha, the 22nd chapter, which is the Connected Suttas on the personality factors, the khandhas, the 5th sutta. And this is very similar to one of the suttas that Venerable Sunya was showing before. But let's just have a quick look at it. So when you seek delight in form, yeah, rupa, when you welcome the form and you remain holding to it, yeah, so you can see here, these are all very similar to the things we have been talking about, yeah, the craving and the upadana and maybe even the bhava are all kind of part of this, yeah. So because of this, you delight in it, yeah. So these things are all kind of interwoven with each other. Very hard to really pull them apart. So because of delight, you delight almost. Yeah, it's kind of revolve around each other. So you delight in form because you hold on to it. And then from that delight, you have then the upadana. Delight is similar to the craving. From the upadana, the grasping, you then have the existence. And then existence becomes the condition for rebirth. Yeah, you can see here, this is almost like, this is dependent origination, but here, with the delight in the 5 khandhas as the foundation. So when you enjoy the 5 khandhas, yay, my body, please don't become old, yeah, I don't want to be old, I don't want to be decrepit, please stay the way you are, yeah, don't change. Of course, you're asking for the impossible, yeah? And then you look yourself in the mirror, you think, oh no, grey hair everywhere, whoa, this is the end. I end this coming very fast. And so if you hold on too much to your body, that's what happens. You start to grieve. You feel depressed when you get old. Yeah, wrinkles coming out everywhere, things falling apart, you're getting sick, you know, things are going downhill. But if you are used to the idea of the things in the Dhamma, you look yourself in the mirror and think, oh yeah, I expected that. Yeah, this is to be expected. Actually, you quite like it because you see reality is just happening and you realize no need to hold on to this body. Yeah, this body, unreliable, does bad things, things I don't want it to do. Let it go. Allow it to do its own thing. Don't worry so much about it. This is actually very liberating, not to have to worry about the body. Because we are so obsessed with the body in the modern world. Yeah, I don't know, I think people are more body obsessed now than ever since I was young. Yeah, I mean, of course, as a youngster, everyone is obsessed with their body. But these days, it seems to be worse than ever with all the internet stuff and all these kind of things going on. So you let go of all of that. And as you do that, your delight in the body dies down. Your grasping onto this dies down. Yeah, and there's a gradual change in your level of existence. Instead of being so interested in the sensory world again, you move towards more peaceful things instead. That is what this looks like. Yeah. So we're getting a little bit late now. It's already 5:30. I'm going to carry on this very tiny bit more, if you don't mind. I'm just going to finish this off. And then I'm very happy to take some questions afterwards as well. But please don't feel shy about leaving. If you have to leave, please leave at any time. We don't have a little book here. We don't have a kind of, you know, red cross against your name or anything like that. Just because you're leaving, you are very welcome to leave at any time. So this is the sutta that Venerable Sunyo showed a couple of days ago. And this is called the Bhava Sutta. This is one of the few suttas that discusses in detail the idea of bhava, or existence. Yeah. And because we have done it before, I can go through it fairly quickly this time. And then Venerable Ananda, he goes to the Buddha and he asks the Buddha, in what way, Bhante, is there existence? And the Buddha replies, if Ananda, there were no kamma ripening in the sensory realm, would there be sense sphere existence? Yeah, so what the Buddha is saying here, for there to be existence in the sensory realm, you have to have sense realm kamma. What is that sense realm kamma? It is the thing inside of you when you calm down and you see where your mind is inclining, where your mind is leaning. If that mind is leaning to sensory things, to things that have to do with the sensory realm, that is sense sphere kamma, yeah, right here, right now. Exactly what kind of sense sphere kamma, whether it's a high realm or low realm, will depend on your actions, yeah, depend on your whether you're doing bad or good actions. But the inclination of the mind will decide whether you're doing this. This is how you know the kamma inside of you right now. You can see where you are leaning, and that will then decide where you get reborn. And perhaps you think that if you are really enjoying your meditation, yeah, oh, I love the peace, it must mean I won't get reborn in the sense realm. You would be wrong. You will still be reborn in the sense realm, but it's a more calm and peaceful sense realm, yeah? Because you still have some attachments to the body. It is only when you take the meditation all the way to the jhana realms that you actually escape the sensory realm altogether. In the meantime, you are actually heading towards this. So all of that in between there is part of sense realm kamma. And Ananda says, no, if there is no sense realm kamma, then there can be no sense sphere existence. And then he has this famous saying that we mentioned before. He says that, thus Ananda, for beings hindered by ignorance, yeah, blinded by ignorance, blinded by avidya, walking in the dark, not knowing what you're doing, yeah, having been clueless about the nature of reality. For these beings, hindered by ignorance and fettered by craving, craving ties you to samsara, ties you to rebirth. It's like a rope that binds you, and you have to follow along as a sheep tied to a leash. Kamma is the field, yeah? Kamma is that field. When you have this inclination of the mind towards kamma, it's like this field stretching out in front of you. Yeah, the kind of all the possibilities in that kamma realm. It's almost like the field in this life when you look out at the world and you see all the various aspects of this world in the various ways. It's like this field of possibilities. Yeah, it's the field of kamma, and then your consciousness, yeah, gets planted in that field. It is the seed that goes to that particular place. So you have created that inclination in this life. The field has been created, and then the consciousness carries on according to that inclination. And then craving is the moisture. You get reborn in that realm, and then the water of the craving comes, and then you sprout up, and you, yay, reborn in a happy realm, in a nice, nice kind of karma realm. I'm going to enjoy myself in the grove of the gods of the 33, and I'm going to run around and enjoy myself. This is so much better than being a human being. Yeah, wow, the sensual pleasures here are really nice. Yeah, I'm going to do this, and surely this must be eternal anyway. Yeah, because I believed in Christianity, and here I can see Sakka is over there. Sakka probably must be the eternal god, and now I'm going to live here forever after. Hooray, And then you die afterwards. That's the downside. And then their consciousness is established there in an inferior realm. Yeah, this is the inferior realm is called the Kama Loka. In this way, there is rebirth in the future. Yeah, the whole idea of creating that Kama, which is like existence in a certain way, and by existing in that way, your consciousness is ready to be planted in that field, and this then is the rebirth. And then depending on what kind of inclination you have, you can then be reborn in the middling realm. The middling realm is the jhana realm. The Buddha is pretty demanding. That's the middling realm is the jhana realm. Yeah, so okay, anyway, and the higher realm, what is that? That is the formless realms, yeah, even beyond the jhanas. So in Buddhism, everything is kind of very lofty and very high. So I'm sorry to say, even to get to the middling realm, you have to practice the jhanas regularly. Yeah? If you haven't even got there, you're still in the inferior realm. How many people in the world are even in the middling realm? Oh, not many. How many people in the world can practice the jhanas? I have no idea how many. I would say a tiny, tiny fraction. Maybe a few thousand people out of billions. Yeah? I'm just making a completely random guess. Of course, I have no idea. It's very hard to know. But that is what the Buddha demands of us. So there you are. That is my take on how I usually explain these factors. Yeah, and so the idea is that we experience the world, we crave based on those experiences of the world. Yeah, because craving has to happen because these things are so fundamental to what it means to be a being, and because we want to satisfy these cravings, we get involved in, yeah, getting involved in is another way of thinking about upadana. We get involved in all of these kind of things to satisfy the craving. Our life takes a certain shape, yeah, that is the bhava. We exist in a certain way. And the way that we exist, combined with all the kamma that we make, decides how we get reborn again in the future. So, if you like, I am quite happy to take some more questions and take some more comments if you want to comment on anything, and see what happens. One up. Yeah. I'll do it. I'll do it here. Okay.
Incarnation equals station of consciousness equals rebirth.
Yeah.
Is it the same thing? So it sounds like bhava and station of consciousness, is it vinyatiti or something? Vinyanatiti?
Yeah.
Like that?
Yeah.
Are they the same thing? Just one is the present life and one is the next life?
They are closely related to each other. Whether they are exactly the same thing, you know, it's hard to say exactly what the Buddha meant by these things. But they are very closely related to each other. I would say they're virtually synonymous, I would say. Bhava, yeah. The way that bhava is traditionally described in the commentaries, it's described as the kama bhava and upapatti bhava. So kama bhava is the kama that you make, yeah? And that is very similar to the vijnana titti, which then is when your consciousness is stationed in a certain place, then you make kama according to where it is stationed. And then you re-arise in accordance with that, yeah? So I would say virtually synonymous, yeah.
My second question was, could upadana be described as the inclination to act on craving?
inclination to act on craving. It's more than that. It is the actual acting on craving. Yeah.
Okay.
Not just the. I think what happens is that first of all comes the actual acting on craving here, and then when you act on craving, that creates the inclination. Yeah. So, for example, if your acting on craving is to enjoy lots of sensual pleasures and you live in that realm, then your mind tends to incline towards sensual pleasures because you have taken that up as your interest. So you can say, in a way, it's both. Yeah, I mean, it all is kind of involved with each other. But it's good to have a certain kind of process to see what's going on here. The Buddha calls it nati, the consciousness is inclined towards something. Yeah? And it usually comes at roughly that particular point. So you crave, you start taking things up to satisfy the craving, and because of all of that, then your mind inclines towards those things as a consequence afterwards. Who's first? Thomas? Yeah, please.
When hearing that you're just an empty process,
yeah.
It's almost kind of like what Morpheus tells Neo, you're this battery. Neo says, I can't believe it. It's just too like earth-shattering. You're just an empty process. And even worse, you're just an empty process of dukkha. Then the only thing that makes sense is, well, luckily the code breaker there have given the only way out, the one and only way out, right?
Yeah.
And nothing else makes sense. Like, okay, I just need to end this process as quick as possible.
Yeah.
But there's just a little problem.
Okay.
The super process, Mara tries to stop it because it seems his only process is to keep that process running.
Yeah.
Is that a kind of...
We have to be very careful here how we say these things, because depending on how you look at the Dhamma, it can look really bleak and terrible and you don't want to have anything to do with it, or it can look just absolutely marvelous. Yeah. So, and this is so important that we actually remember the other side of the equation. So what does it mean that it is an empty process? This is what you have to remember. So what it means is that when you sit down in meditation, you can bliss out. That's what it means. It means that when you let go of things in your meditation practice, the more you let go of who you think you are, your body, your thoughts, the more happy you are. And you think, cheapest, this emptiness stuff is actually marvelous. Yeah, there's so much happiness bound up with emptiness. If there were a self to get in the way, I wouldn't want to have a self, because the self gets in the way of all this happiness. For goodness sake, keep the self out of the way. Yeah, the self just, because the self has a solidity. Once the self is there, you cannot go beyond that. So if the body is the self, you can't go beyond the body. You can't let it go. You can't really enjoy meditation. So you should be bleeding happy. Lucky, you're so lucky to not have a self, because the self would actually stop the process from happening. And this is what you see in meditation. The more things cease, the more emptiness you realize, the more you start to understand that this actually is a very, very, very positive thing. It's really enjoyable. It is so peaceful. It is so beautiful. And you think, yeah, actually this makes good sense. But when you look at it from the other point of view, yeah, this is just a, dukkha and an empty process of dukkha carrying on, then it sounds very bleak. Yeah. But the experiential side of things is very beautiful. But the theoretical side of things may seem very bleak. Yeah. Is that what you were asking, or do you want to elaborate?
It's kind of very earth-shattering. It's just an empty process.
So, I know what you mean. And that is why it is so important that we think about this in the right way. Because if you only get one side of the story, then it becomes really hard, and really negative. I know a man, there's a man I have known for many, many years, and he said that he had some very serious problems with depression. Yeah, really, really serious. He lay in bed sometimes for months at the time, couldn't move. Yeah, he was completely out of it. And then he would get out, and then he would be really happy, he would meditate, and then suddenly the depression would come back again. It was like this yo-yo life, this manic depressive or whatever it is. And he said there was no treatment for it. He had tried everything, there was no treatment for it. Until one day he realized that he had taken the Buddhist teachings in the wrong way. Yeah, it's all so bleak, it's all so terrible. Yeah, and then he realized, actually, when I think like that, it makes existence seem so terrible. All I want to do is blot it all out, lie in bed all the time, and have nothing to do with existence. So that is what it can lead to, if you take it the wrong way. It can lead to some, you know, terrible consequences like that. It makes us super, super duper depressed. So please don't take it in that way. Yeah. And so, because that would be kind of really counterproductive. So remember the positive side of this.
Ajay, is there a distinction between karma, upadana, and the second factor, sankhara, as the second factor of the 12 formula?
Yeah, well, that's what the question we had before, very similar to that, yeah? That upadana, I think, is when you have upadana, then it kind of creates, in a large part, it creates the framework for your karma that you're making here. Yeah, because you have upadana, you have taken up a number of things, you live in a certain way according to the attachments and takings ups that you have. So because you have all of these things, then you tend to act within that sphere of the of all the attachments that you have, or all the things you have taken up. And because you act within that sphere, you tend to make karma as a, you know, which relates to that. So, you know, if you get into, if you have some belongings and you're attached to them and someone tries to steal your belongings, you might do some bad things as a consequence, yeah? And that comes from the upadana, the attachment that you have, and then you make bad karma as a consequence of that. So it is within the sensual realm, but it's bad karma within the sensual realm. Or you can make good karma within the sensual realm because it is positive, but it relates to those attachments. So the attachments in upadana kind of creates a framework, and then you act within that framework, I would say, within that kind of existence.
Upadana and mental karma?
Mental karma too, same kind of thing, yeah? So you have those attachments, and then you think about it, you reflect on it, and someone says, I'm going to steal your car. And you think, no way, you think, absolutely not. I'm going to, you know, break your leg before you get a chance to steal my car. So you're making bad mental karma or something like that. Or you are kind to somebody because it fits with what's happening in the karma realm, yeah? So you make karma within that thing. But if you then go to the jhana realms instead, and you are attached to that, and you are holding on to that, you don't make any bad karma anymore, because now there is no external threats to you. It's only in the sensual realm that there are external threats to your enjoyment of the sensual world. Yeah, so that's where the problem arises. In the karma loka, in the jhana realms, everything is internal, and then there is no basis for making bad karma anymore. You just make good karma in that realm. So it changes according to the realms, according to what you are holding on to. What you are holding on to will then decide you're a bit, you know, you make whether you make good or bad karma.
So the taking up itself is not a karma.
It is as well. Yeah, sure. That is also karma. Yeah. So when you, that's also karma. So it that is karma in itself, and then there's more karma when you act according. Yeah, sure, absolutely. Sometimes you take up bad things, yeah, so or good things or whatever.
As the second factor which drives vijnana, it's pretty much the same thing there.
Yeah, because that's the willed activity. The taking up is a willed activity. Yeah, so they're very closely related. So craving, upadana, and bhava, it is almost like a dividing up of sankhara into three separate aspects. Yeah, but sankhara really involves all of them. Bhava may be more related to vijnana, actually, in some ways. But certainly tanha and upadana are basically equivalent to sankhara, I would say. Yeah. Okay. Alrighty. Would you like to add anything, Venerable Sunil?
No, not much because it's late, but I would say if anybody feels challenged about the idea of empty process ceasing, then I would say maybe you're starting to understand what the Buddha was all about. Because a spiritual path should be challenging, I feel. If it was easy, then we would have all penetrated a long time ago. And it's exactly because it's challenging and because it's hard that we stay in samsara for such a long time. But there is a way out, which is the good news, yes, which will be good. And we'll talk about that next week.
And sometimes you have to look at the results of the practice. Look at some of the people who practiced, you know, for years and years and years, and they tell you, oh, there's no self. Yay, they're so happy. And these are some of the most blissful people. I don't know, you saw the picture of Ajahn Gandha before. Yeah? And he looks like that all the time. Yeah? You go to his monastery, he always smiles, he always looks happy. Yeah? And you wonder how it's possible. And then you ask him a really tricky question. Yeah? And then he smiles back at you. Oh, yeah. You know, forget about that. Yeah.
Oh, that's how we should start answering some questions.
Okay.
Forget about that. I don't know. It's probably not like that.
But, yeah. But so sometimes you look at the products of the path. There's someone who actually, at least to all appearances, has practiced this path for a long time and who probably it looks like anyway that they have achieved some of these things. And they are happy. Yeah, the Buddha didn't. The Buddha was pretty happy probably. And you still see some examples of that in the present day. So that's kind of a very uplifting. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Anything else? Any last chance? Yeah, today is the second last Saturday we're going to be doing this. So now, if your life depends on it, now is your chance to ask it. Yeah, and to get...
If your cessation of life depends on it.
That is actually much better. Yeah, if you remember, your cessation of life might depend on this. Yeah, so if you really want to cease, now is your opportunity. Okay,
all right.
Marvelous. Very nice to see you all again today. Let's... Oops. Okay, quick edit. Yeah, last one.
Yes.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for the course, you know.
Yeah.
Gives me a chance, I'm sure all of you too, look at ourselves, you know. You know, and then to sort of to correct our ways of life.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
Good. Great. Thank you, Eddie, for those positive
words. Thanks, Eddie. You're the best.
Yeah. So let's pay respect to the Dhamma Sangha together.